Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In March of 2003, when American tanks were rolling into Baghdad, the story of the invasion was largely sent home by embedded American reporters. They were perched behind the hard steel of the American military and largely outside a thick barrier of Iraqi culture and language. The Pulitzer Prize-winning Arab-American correspondent for The Washington Post, Anthony Shadid, went deeper. Shadid, fluent in Arabic, reported from the back streets and shaken living rooms of Iraq, and he captured the fine-grained, complex story of individual Iraqis. In his new book, Night Draws Near, Shadid tells the story of the Iraq War from the Iraqi perspective. He listens to the Iraqi conversation, which he says is focused not on so much an American version of freedom, but on a native idea of justice. He brings us into the lives of insurgents, widows, hearts, and families torn by war. This hour on Point, Anthony Shadid and the Iraqi view of the Iraq War. You can join the conversation. Are Americans seeing through the preconceptions to what's really going on in Iraq? What do you hear in the intimate stories of Anthony Shadid? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Anthony Shadid will join us in just a moment, but first, we want to begin this hour with the latest direct from Baghdad. Michael Hastings is a correspondent there for Newsweek magazines and joins us. Michael, thanks for being with us.
No problem. Thanks for having me, Tom.
So we're looking at the headlines of the last day or two. Number two in Al-Qaeda in Iraq killed, a bomber found inside the highly defended green zone, and more another suicide bombing today. What's the profile of news coming out of Baghdad this week, Michael?
I think you can say it's your regular day in Baghdad. The insurgent leader, Zarqawi's number two, was obviously killed yesterday. What that means for the insurgency is still probably, no one really knows. I doubt it will be that devastating of a blow. It was a big shock yesterday when they found a suicide car bomb within the green zone. It's, as you know, and as you said, the most heavily fortified area of the city. That's a serious security breach. It was on its way towards the American embassy. And then you have, your average body count today is, it's 30 dead here, 6 dead here. A female suicide bomber turned up in Iraq today, which was one of the first times that has happened. So from the day to day, it's similar. It's a similar profile.
Michael, what are the implications of a bomb being found so deep in the green zone? Does that suggest complicity by Iraqi employees there? Could it happen any other way? I understand it was dozens of checkpoints in.
I think what needs to be remembered is the resentment that many people in Baghdad have towards the Green Zone. We have power. The Green Zone has power, electricity, or at least not all the time, but at least it's thought to have. It kind of glows while the rest of the city is in darkness. There is, the American embassy is in Saddam's old palace. It's basically taken over a chunk of the town. So one would suspect that there is enough people who would be interested in hurting people inside the Green Zone to make that happen. And obviously there are, because this isn't the first time. This was one of the biggest security breaches, I believe, but there had also been suicide bombings at checkpoints around the Green Zone over the past few months.
And Michael, look ahead for us just briefly here. We've got a referendum coming up on the Constitution, such as it is, Saddam Hussein's trial coming up, and Ramadan. How do these converge?
There's three major forces all happening in the same month. In terms of the biggest factor for the future of Iraq might be the Constitution. This will decide how the country is going to look from here on out if it's approved. Saddam's trial will be largely, I think, symbolic, especially important to the Americans. The Iraqis I've spoken to, even those from Saddam's hometown of Tikrit, haven't been too concerned about what happens in the trial. And then you have Ramadan and the amount of attacks that has been escalating over the past few weeks seems to be timed to at least Ramadan and the referendum.
And what about you, Michael? Do you get to go out these days, or is your reporting from behind a wall?
It depends. I've gone out and about the country a good amount of time, but any time you go out here, you have to weigh the risk versus the reward in terms of what risk you're going to take for what stories. I know Mr. Shadid has taken plenty of risks, and I'm excited to buy his book just after hearing you talk about it. But as far as what our day-to-day life is like, we judge the security situation by the day and try to go after stories based on that.
Michael Hastings in Baghdad with Newsweek. We appreciate your reporting there. We wish you good luck, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
We are talking this hour about the Iraqi view of the war in Iraq with Arab American Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for The Washington Post, Anthony Shadid. He is author of Night Draws Near, Iraq's People in the Shadow of America's War. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Anthony Shadid joins me now in the studio. Anthony, it's great to have you. Thanks for being here.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
So many questions right in the title of your book, America's War. Not Iraq's, not Iraqis. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think it was one of the ambitions that I think went into writing the book was to see this intersection of two political cultures, of two cultures in a way that are intersecting in these certain conditions at this certain time, and that's what the book's about in a lot of ways, is how those intersection might not be the right word, it might be more collision, but this collision that we've seen over the past two or three years and what that does to a situation. I mean, when we talk about you mentioned a couple of times that this is the Iraqi view of the war, in some ways I kind of see the war and the occupation is in a way kind of a backdrop to what's in some ways more of a universal experience. And I think this is another ambition in doing the book, was these kind of universal notions of pride, of dignity, of frustration, of disappointment, of resilience, these things that do emerge in these times of conflict. And, again, that's what, I guess that in a way the subtitle is kind of misleading, because it is about Iraq's people, it is about America's war, but it's also about a more maybe universal notion of how we respond in times of crisis.
We'll look at that, but I want to ask, because it really turned my head, do Iraqis not see this as their war? George Bush says America will stand down as Iraqis stand up. That suggests that they're in it. Your title suggests something else. And do Iraqis see it as America's war, even though it's playing out on their soil, in their homes?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. And I think, what I'm struck by time and again, I think back to this conversation I have had many times with a widow who's a mother of eight, and I met her first during the invasion in 2003. And she would always make this, she would always remark to me that she felt like she was watching a play, that they were spectators, that the script was already written, that the actors were reading their lines, and she was sitting in the audience watching this thing play out. And I think there's still that feeling a little bit, that a lot of the people in Baghdad and in Iraq are spectators to something that they don't necessarily have a lot of control over.
We want to hear your stories in detail, but there's this big overarching message in the book that Americans kind of brought their sense of reality in Iraq along with them. And that to a great extent, as I read you, they're still living in it. Even though they're in Iraq, it's within their own bubble of comprehension of what's happening there, what's going on, what it's all about. What is that, if I got you right, and what's the gap? What's the American view versus the Iraqi view, if we can generalize that one?
It's true, and I've always felt that there were two languages being spoken in Iraq. I mean, in the obvious sense, there's Arabic and English, but, I think in a deeper sense, in a more kind of symbolic sense, there are two vocabularies, two sets of ideas, and I think it's really rare. And I think it was rare during the invasion in 2003, and I think it's rare today where one side hears the other. I don't know if it's necessarily two sets of ideas. I think there is that. I think you mentioned one earlier, this idea of, for instance, maybe the Americans talking about this word freedom, where I think to many Iraqis, the idea of justice is a more powerful, more resonant idea. But I think it's also, in a sense, a priority or a sense of perspective. I think a lot of people in this country, you know, ask about democracy or ask about Iraqis embracing freedom or, you know, or what the fall of Saddam might have brought them. You know, I think just in almost every conversation I have, the priorities are less that, and the priorities are more the day-to-day challenges of getting by, basically, of, you know, what happens when you don't have electricity and it's 130 degrees outside? What happens when you still carry buckets of water up two flights of stairs because there is no running water? You know, the crime, the car bombs that go off in front of houses. I mean, these are so overwhelming, they're almost suffocating in a way, and I think politics at a certain level become an indulgence.
For Iraqis, looking at their own future, trying just to survive, freedom can seem far away. Justice, if they're focused on that, what's the justice? What are the kind of icons? What are they thinking of when they thirst for, want, seek justice?
I think it's a sense, I think the way that we often see it playing out in day-to-day life is this sense of deserving better. It's a sense of, you know, when you look back at Iraqi history over maybe 20 or 30 years, it's a breathtaking record. And I don't mean that in a good way. I mean, we're looking at a war in the 1980s with Iran that lasted for 8 years and left 1 million dead and wounded on both sides. Looking at a decade of sanctions that basically wiped out the middle class in Iraq. And then one of the world's most brutal dictatorships. I mean, it's a story of deprivation, of tyranny, of repression. And I think when we talk about justice or we talk about, you know, maybe more specifically expectations, it was that, you know, that things were going to get better, that Iraqis deserve better, that this is finally their moment to, you know, to be able to have a life that's different than the life they've had over the past generation. And I think that's what's been the greatest disappointment. There's almost a sense of injustice in those expectations not being met.
Expectations out of a deep history. You remind us of this word, I don't know how to pronounce it, tabagdada. Meaning to swagger or show off. I mean, Baghdad is the heart of that word, as if it was like to New York.
Right.
meaning swagger, and the swagger pretty much punched down.
That's right. I think so. And it's what Baghdad, I think, is in the collective Arab memory still, that kind of image of what it once was.
Anthony Shadid, we're going to dive into your stories. We've got to take a short break here. We're talking about the Iraqi view of the war in Iraq with Pulitzer Prize-winning Arab-American correspondent Anthony Shadid. His new book is Night Draws Near, Iraq's People in the Shadow of America's War. You can join us. Do Americans really know who and what they're dealing with in Iraq? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the Iraqi view of the war in Iraq this hour with Anthony Shadid, Pulitzer Prize-winning correspondent for The Washington Post, author of the terrific new book, Night Draws Near, Iraq's People in the Shadow of America's War. You can join the conversation. What if the American vision of Iraq in the Middle East turns out not to be Iraq's vision? And can you empathize with what Anthony Shadid found among Iraqis, a desire for justice before freedom? Can America deliver that? What do you hear in Shadid's stories of the intimate lives and minds of Iraqis? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Anthony Shadid, a family of Lebanese descent, we want to talk about your personal story, but you've been doing a lot of talking about Iraq just on this point. You've been watching American audiences respond to the many stories that you've got in this substantial book. I wish you could share with us the moments or the anecdotes that drop the dime, that kind of get through and help Americans see what you've glimpsed, that is, the through-the-looking-glass view of this war, the Iraqi view of what's going on. What are the moments or anecdotes that best seem to do that, Anthony?
You know, it's interesting because I think it's so rare, and I've talked about this with colleagues in Baghdad. I think it's so rare for us to see this kind of an unvarnished window from an Iraqi on Iraq, on you know this unvarnished window on the country itself and how it's changing. And it is changing in ways that I find just almost incredibly dramatic over the past couple of years. You know, I think there's one diary that I try to share with people often. It's an entry written by a young girl that I met during the invasion. She was 14 at the time. She's 16 now. And this entry actually isn't in the book, but it's she'd shared it with me more recently over this past summer. And, you know, she writes it after a car bomb goes off in front of her house. Three more car bombs follow. And she writes her reaction. And it's such, you know, in a country that's often cast in terms of black and white, It's an entry that embraces the gray, and I've just been so struck by it. I read it over and over. She's mad at this is the first time she's seen violence up close. Mm. She's mad at the insurgents for the carnage. She's mad at the U.S. military for not protecting her. She's mad at her own government for being ineffective. And then she talks about this one scene that happens in her street in front of her house. An American soldier goes there to hand out water bottles at the side of the explosion. And, you know, it's a gesture of trying to help. And she watches the scene unfold. This is a 16-year-old girl. Mm. There's a long line of Iraqis, and she says, look at the Iraqis standing in line in a humiliating way. It's like they're beggars. And then she mentions that the soldier hands the camera to a translator to take a few pictures. And I thought that was such a complicated portrait of what was going on in that scene, you know, in that street at that moment, something that I had never heard before.
It comes through again and again, this sense of offended pride. Americans may be there to do a good thing, may not. Iraqis with their long history don't know. Occupation, they've seen that before with the British, and it lasted for decades.
Right.
But this sense that simply the presence of the American soldier in the street with the power, with the gun, as a kind of offense to the sense of nationality.
Right. I think that's exactly right. And, you know, in some way, I've sometimes said to colleagues and friends that in some ways Iraq felt the most Arab to me of any country I've visited.
What do you mean when you say that?
And
that
I mean
something specific.
Yeah, I mean a sense of, you know, the power that tradition exerts through culture, the power that pride and dignity play in how people relate to other people and how people see events transpiring around them. Pride, like you just mentioned, pride and dignity are incredibly powerful forces, and I think those are at the heart of the reaction, in a way, in the west and north of Iraq to the presence of American troops. I mean, you know, I think what you're, you know, the point you're making, I think, is an important point, and I think it's something that I've asked myself a lot. And is there something inevitable about occupation that led us to this point? And I don't know the answer
this
to that.
This point being, define that for us. It's clear to you, but maybe less clear to us looking on.
I hate to sound bleak when I say this, but I mean, to me, this point is the semblance of a civil war, if not already a civil war, in play in Iraq. When we look at the level of violence, when we look at the rivalries that are going on there, when we look at the factions that are aligned against each other, I mean, I think there is basically a civil war. And it's a civil war that was, I think, is the result of consequences that we served as a catalyst in bringing about with the fall of Saddam. We unleashed forces that I think have reshaped the country to a remarkable degree, and in a way they've set the stage for this civil war. So was this civil war, or were these forces that we've unleashed, or is the situation as it is today, was it inevitable because of an occupation? I don't know the answer, but some things, I guess, you know, I guess when I spend time there now, and I just got back a few weeks ago, some things did feel inevitable to me, in a way.
It's a something just baked in the cake of occupation, implicit in the whole idea that leads to resistance. But there is, you start with a story of a young girl and her diary and that complex set of emotions that she feels. But in the book, Night Draws Near, you take us all the way to the much more extreme response, where mm-hmm. pride and dignity, and you tell us what else lead people to become insurgents. Take us into those lives, their homes, those individuals' lives. What right. makes the Iraqi insurgent, or the ones you most intimately portray here, Anthony?
Yeah, I was, you know, there's one story I remember in particular. Well, there's two stories I remember in particular that I thought, I guess, was my best glimpse at what was going on. You know, there was one story about four men, and I had been looking, back then in the summer of 2003, I was reluctant to talk to insurgents who were still living because I just didn't want to be duped. I think as a journalist, you're always worried about somebody just making up a story and that you kind of go along with it. So back then, in that summer of 2003, I was only doing stories on insurgents who had been killed, and I was trying to piece together their lives, try to recreate their lives in a way to understand why they did what they did. You know, and I was struck. Let me talk about the first story. It was about a young man who lived in a village. I mean, not even really a village. It was a hamlet called Al-Walwan, and it was near Fallujah, which most people are pretty familiar with, as kind of emerges as a symbol of the insurgency. You know, I tried to find out what he was killed in this attack, and I tried to find out why he did. And some people said, well, it was religion. You know, he thought it was a obligation as a Muslim to resist the occupier. Some people said, no, he's a nationalist. He just got angry. He saw these tanks going over his, you know, going along a road that overlooked his house day after day, and he finally felt like he had to act. And then, you know, other people actually said, and they kind of whispered this, but they said, no, that's not the case. You know, he was an opportunist. It was about money. Baathist had paid him hundreds of dollars to carry out this attack. And I guess what I was struck when I went back to Baghdad to write the story, there was a couple of things. I didn't know the answer, to be honest. It might have been a little of each of those things. It may have been none of the above. But more importantly, I think I was struck by the fact that it didn't matter. You know, that he'd become a martyr in this hamlet's eyes, in the village's eyes. He'd become a hero in a way. And whatever his motivation was paled before what his record was in death, and that kind of setting an example.
But a martyr and a hero as an insurgent in opposition to the United States.
That's right.
You tell famously another story of a family forced to shoot and kill their own son
right.
because he cooperated with the United States.
And I think that was the second story I mentioned. You know, that was a very complicated. It happened in a different village, actually in a different region of Iraq. And I think there was a lot of talk at that time about how people were cooperating with the U.S. military to weed out the insurgents, to end this. You know, it was their very beginning stages of the insurgency, but to put an end to what the Pentagon was casting as dead enders and remnants and leftovers and this type of thing. And here was, I thought, the more kind of menacing side to that. Here was a guy who did cooperate with the military. He wore a mask over his head. He was from the village, and he pointed out people that the military should arrest. They arrested dozens, maybe even hundreds, to be honest, for a brief period. People soon realized who he was. He was missing, I think, half his pinky, if I recall mm-hmm. right. And some people noticed that. They also noticed his gait, just the mm-hmm. way he walked.
And identified him by that.
And in a village, everybody knows everybody else. And so they soon identified him. Three people had died during this raid. And the village leaders, adhering to a tribal notion of justice, a tribal notion of justice that had grown up in this vacuum of authority, told this guy's father that he, to settle the vendetta, as a form of vengeance, he had to kill his son, or these village leaders were going to kill the rest of his family.
And the father and another son, a brother, went into the back lot, the backyard, and did just that.
And they killed him. And when I interviewed the father several weeks later, he said something to me that still haunts me. He said to me that not even the prophet Abraham had to kill his son. I remember his eyes started welling up, and then he just said to me simply that there. In his words, there was no other choice.
We're talking with Anthony Shadid, Pulitzer Prize-winning correspondent for The Washington Post, author of the new book, Night Draws Near. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. Ken's calling from Waverly, Iowa. Hi, Ken. You're on the air. What do you think?
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can, Ken.
Okay, yeah. Well, one of the things that I'm concerned about, I didn't support going into Iraq, but now that we're there and spending a lot of money, it's really frustrating. What I would say is a lot of people standing around and not seeming to want to fight for their own country. And I guess I don't understand the occupation mindset, or as he's talking about the historical perspective on being occupied, but I just don't see how we can continue to bear the brunt of this war if these people, and maybe I'm misperceiving it, but they don't seem to have the drive to liberate themselves. To me, everybody ought to be in a uniform if they really want to liberate their own country, and they have a great opportunity right now.
So, as you see it, this is the moment. Stand up, Iraqis, and take it. Ken, it's a great question, and let me put it to Anthony Shadid. And this is a question I think many Americans would ask. The way the war's been presented, the way it's understood here, this looks like a golden opportunity. You've got a superpower who's come in, taken out a brutal dictator, and said, we want you to have democracy and a great future. You hear Ken's question.
And I think it's a good question. Like you said, I think it's a question a lot of people do ask. Let me start off, maybe I can kind of complicate the picture a little bit when we talk about this very idea of occupation. And I think to a lot of Americans, when we think of occupation, we probably think of Japan and Germany after World War II. It's a powerful example. I mean, it's an example that in the end was rather benevolent, and they were returned to a community of nations. They become strong and prosperous. I think when people in the Arab world, I think when people in Iraq think of the word occupation, they think of the word ihtilal, which is a very different word in Arabic, and it suggests not Japan or Germany. It suggests Israel and Palestine, or it suggests not all together distant past in Iraq after World War I when the British were in control of the country. So the Americans may have come in as liberators, and they were liberators. They also soon became occupiers, and they are occupiers, and that occupation creates a lot of baggage, to be blunt. It creates a lot of imagery. It creates a lot of history that I don't know if the Americans can escape necessarily. And I think that's one of the things here is that however benevolent we may be in this project, there's not a deep reservoir of trust of U.S. intentions, of what the U.S. intends to do. And I think we're still dealing with that. I think back to It was with another reporter, Steve Faneru, with the Washington Post. We were doing a story about the Iraqi security forces, and Steve had embedded with the American military, and I spent the time with the Iraqi army. This is in a place called Beji, which is a scene of the insurgency. And I remember talking to this one guy. He was 19 years old. He was a good soldier. He was a corporal. And we were on a raid soon after dawn, and we started talking about this question. I said, you know, what are you fighting for?
This is an American soldier.
No, this was an Iraqi soldier.
Oh, excuse me. Okay.
Yeah, Iraqi soldier. I said, what are you fighting for? And this Iraqi soldier, you know, he couldn't answer the question. And we kept talking about it, He finally came up with this answer. He's fighting for what he had before the invasion. Not for, and, you know, I thought about that, and he didn't.
What does that mean?
Exactly. And I thought, you know, what, and I thought about, I wanted to make sure I understood what it meant. And it didn't mean a return of Saddam. That's not what he wanted. I think very, very, very few people in Iraq would want to return for Saddam. I think people are often nostalgic for the stability or security that Saddam's time might have represented.
Order.
Exactly. But I think it's just, you know, and I think that's what his lens on it. It wasn't he wanted a return of Saddam. He wanted a return to a time when he knew what would happen the next day, when there was a certain certainty to daily life that, you know, the next day wouldn't necessarily bring a surprise, that, you know, it was a more ordinary life.
But what about the whole American vision of Iraq as a democracy, prosperous again, the seat of democracy in a region, at peace, reformed in a democratic direction? All this to American ears sounds like a hugely inviting future. If you're saying that that has no purchase on the Iraqi mind, then I mean, it seems to go to the very fundamental sort of notion behind this war and undermine it. Is it really that foreign an idea, or that uninviting an idea?
Yeah, it's not, and I don't want to say that, because I don't think there's anything about Iraq or Iraqi culture or even the sentiments of people that is against democracy. I mean, the opposite. I think people do want a democratic future, a future in which they can claim their government. But I think when we look at what's happened in Iraq in its recent past, and we look at what's happening in Iraq now, like I said earlier, it becomes overwhelming. I mean, the story is less an idealistic notion of a democratic future, and it's more how do you treat the deprivation that has so dominated Iraqi life over the past 20 or 30 years and the deprivation that continues today. It's just hard to talk politics. It's probably hard to envision, you know, drafting a constitution when there is no electricity, when there is no water, when life is so difficult in so many ways, to try to get people to engage in that when they're not sure what the next day is going to bring, I think it's a challenge. It's a tough task.
Anthony Shadid, you're almost a unique interpreter. We're lucky to be in a country where we have people like you in our midst. Family, grandparents, I guess, who came from Lebanon, Christian, Lebanese. You grew up in Oklahoma, but still that was very much alive in sort of the breast of your family. You studied Arabic. You describe the moment when Americans are rolling into Baghdad at last, and you're watching. And you're watching as an American correspondent, but also as an Arab-American correspondent. And you say your emotions were complicated at that moment. Maybe that's a way into helping us understand. What was the complication of your emotions?
You know, it's I didn't know that much about Iraq before I went there as a reporter. And so, you know, 1998, 2002, and then for the invasion itself, it was in a way me trying to learn about Iraq, me trying to understand Iraq. And I think it hit me most powerfully as I was standing in that street the day that Saddam fell. I mean, this is April 9th, 2003. It was actually a few hours before the statue came down. And I was watching the American armored column come down Saadun Street. And it just, it was, you know, I was flooded with emotions. In fact, I remember just almost, you know, being frozen for a few minutes. I mean, there was overwhelming relief. You know, here I was a journalist, and I'm watching the American tanks come in. I knew I wasn't going to die.
You had stayed in Baghdad. You'd been on the other side of the lines as the onslaught began.
And I thought at that time that the war was over. I had no idea what was going to follow, to be honest. And so I was tired of the bloodshed. I was tired of the bombing, and I was so relieved that I finally felt safe in a way. And then it was more as an Arab American. You know, I was watching Baghdad, a city that is fabled in a way. I think in Arab memory, and I watched a city like Baghdad being conquered in the name of its liberation, and that made me, you know, I didn't feel joy, I didn't feel sadness, or I didn't feel joy, I didn't feel anger, I felt, I think, just grief, that this was the fate of a city to be conquered, at the same time to be, you know, in a way to be liberated, and then as
kind
an American,
of grief for the jewel, this jewel of the Arab world.
Like you pointed out a little bit earlier, this word Baghdad, you know, that a word that means
swagger. Show off with the word Baghdad embedded right in the middle of it,
and it comes from the city itself. I mean, the name is drawn from the verb is drawn from the city, and it's a city that still represents such an idea. I mean, I think it's more, you know, in my sense, you know, Baghdad as a memory is more an idea than a physical place. I think when people in the Middle East talk about Baghdad, it doesn't represent Saadun Street or Fatehdoh Square or the downtown or the hotels. It represents this idea of what Baghdad once was and what it represented and is no longer in a lot of ways. And there's a certain nostalgia about that.
Yet Americans wanted to imagine it somehow, that great history fused with a bright new future, and off we'd go. And you're saying it's a lot more complicated than that. And I have to tell you, it's scary to hear all that complication, but necessary. We're talking about the Iraqi view of the war in Iraq with Anthony Shadid, Washington Post correspondent, Pulitzer Prize winner, Arab American. His new book is Night Draws Near. You can join the conversation. Is America seeing the true story of the Iraq War? Is the U.S. blinded by its own desires in Iraq? And what does the Iraqi view tell us about where we are headed? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, BICON.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Anthony Shadid, Pulitzer Prize-winning correspondent for The Washington Post, who's won a slew of other awards right behind for his reporting from Iraq on the war there and before. He really brings us the view of Iraqis of everything that's going on in his new book, Night Draws Near, Iraq's People in the Shadow of America's War. He's with me in the studio. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. Steve is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi, I'm calling. I don't have any personal experience with Iraq, but I do have a lot of personal experience with Lebanon. I know many people there, and I travel there frequently. And one personal story I'd like to share is we know this kid. My wife just got a birthday card from him. It just closes capital letters, I love USA. And this is a 10-year-old kid, Muslim family, and it's representative of a lot of goodwill that I see when I toward America and Americans when I travel there.
So it's all coming up roses, is it? Or there's
no,
something?
No. I'm very concerned that when the kid grows up and things have been handled the way they have been handled since 9/11, that goodwill will evaporate or worse. And so what I'd like to ask Mr. Shadid is, his view, I think I heard that you're talking about administration competence in your second hour. I draw my own conclusions. I think that this has been, I have grave concerns about administration competence in conducting our foreign policy and its effect on American prestige and standing and what that does to our national interest. And so,
Steve, let us pick it up. You've got a lot on the table right there. Anthony Shadid, you write in the book that America had brought a revolution to Iraq, what you call a revolution without ambition and an upheaval without design. Steve wants to know, where's the competence here? I mean, it also goes to strategy. What do you mean a revolution without ambition and upheaval without design?
You know, I think that, there has been a lot of talk of democracy, liberation, freedom, individual rights, these types of notions, and I think it's talked more and more about the longer this goes on. I think when we look back to the invasion itself, though, you know, the centerpiece of the project was the overthrow of Saddam. Mm-hmm. That was the centerpiece of the project, and I think that explains a lot why there was abysmally poor planning for the aftermath. The aftermath just wasn't seen as the centerpiece. It really was seen as a project to overthrow Saddam and the Ba'athist government in Iraq. What we've seen now, though, is, of course, that the aftermath has become the centerpiece. And, you know, part of me worries that what we're seeing now is the preamble to something far grander drama, which I have no idea what it's going to bring. But
you say grander as if it's a synonym for worse.
Yeah. I mean, I think the caller makes a good point. And, you know, and that's what I said at the outset, this idea of two political cultures colliding or intersecting, but I think more often colliding. And it's nothing essential about either the United States or Iraq or the United States and the Arab world. But We're talking about a generation of grievances. We're talking about grievances that have been built over, the U.S. alliance with Israel, over the U.S. alliance with some Arab governments that are very authoritarian. A certain distrust of U.S. intentions in Iraq, for instance, when the record after the 1991 Gulf War, when there's very much a deep sense among Shiites in Iraq that the U.S. abandoned the rebels after the 1991 Gulf War.
When they rose up against Saddam Hussein, and the U.S. didn't come in to support them.
Exactly. Another reason for some of the same ambivalence that I think you see in southern Iraq. So, part of me does worry that we have this record of grievances, that these grievances are deep, that it's not going to be easy to break through these grievances. And, when I say a preamble to what's ahead, I see in Iraq a growing radicalization, particularly within the insurgency. I see a growing militancy, and I don't think it's necessarily going to just play out in Iraq either. I hope I'm wrong.
This is the spillover the borders scenario you're describing.
And spillover the borders in ways that might not be, might not just be insurgents going across the borders. It might be, spillover of ideas, of images, of examples.
A fundamentalist, radical ideas. And yet, talking about collisions, there was the collision of 9/11, and Americans looked at that and said, my gosh, we have to do something. The Bush administration filled in the blanks, first with Afghanistan, then with Iraq. But I think most Americans thought, we've got to respond to this amount, whether they thought violently or with some other path. Here you are, the Arab-American observer who's been deep in both sides of this equation. Was there an entirely different avenue of response?
That's a good question. And to be honest, people have asked this question, since I've been back in the United States. And I don't understand the relationship of September 11th to Iraq. I simply don't. I don't see where it's at. I think we're creating a relationship in a way after two or three years there, but I don't see what the relationship was in the first place.
Well, even if you buy none of the connections, the Bush administration line is, this was a problem from an undemocratic region under oppressive regimes, and we're going to change that. We're going to start with this guy, Saddam.
It's interesting. I think because when we were speaking about some of those experiences I had in the summer of 2003 when it was very easy to report in Iraq, and it's not that easy to report anymore. I think back that there was this notion of Iraq changing the rest of the region. I think it was a powerful notion.
You're using past tense.
I think it's still there. It's hard to see the example Iraq's going to set at this point. But, what struck me, especially when I was talking about this young man in this town of Al-Balwan, it struck
me
the hero, martyr, insurgent. It wasn't Iraq changing the rest of the Arab world. It was the rest of the Arab world changing Iraq. And that really struck me because, what were the people who were the people he listened to? There were people like Abdelhamid Kishk, an Egyptian preacher who was banned in the 1970s and passed away in the mid-90s. Another guy named Abu Qaqa, who was a radical Syrian preacher. These guys had never been in Iraq before.
So the iron cage of Saddam taken away, and instead of rising to the democratic song, he's rising to this kind of Islamic fundamentalist.
Influences were pouring across the border, and this was, and you could buy these CDs for, I think it was 50 cents, if I recall right. And they were in Fallujah, they were in Ramadi, they were in Qadiyah. And there was another group of insurgents I met. They would watch these guys every night.
And just soak it up. And it wasn't exactly the Star Spangled Banner they were listening to. Mark is calling from Alexandria, Virginia. Mark, what do you think?
Hello, gentlemen.
Hi.
Before we even went into Iraq, I kind of saw it as a catch-22 in that our democracy is based on, and a lot of Western democracies, is based on a separation of church and state politically. And when we went into Iraq, we didn't have a strong enough unifying vision, kind of those esoteric democratic principles. And I think it broke up the country, and they sort of reflexively went to the more stable communities and their Muslim religion for a unifying vision. And now I think we're in kind of a catch-22 where we have to embrace the Muslim religion as that unifying vision, however it might come in conflict with the ability of democracy to succeed there.
Got it. It goes back to the old question of compatibility of this religion and this ideal. Mark, thanks for your call. Anthony?
Again, a good question. I think it's very interesting. Here I'm going to take a little bit, I'm going to have a little bit different take on this. And I think it has less to do with the power of religion in Iraq to define politics and more the power, take this step by step, more the power of our preconception of what Iraq was. And what do I mean by that? I think we went into, and I put myself among this. I think I saw it this way as well before I went to cover the invasion. Mm-hmm. We saw Iraq as a country of Shiites, Sunnis, and Kurds. That was our notion of it.
I think a lot of people still do.
A lot of truth to it. There was a lot of truth to it before the invasion. It wasn't the only truth. There were other realities there. But I think in a way, 2 years later, 2.5 years later, the reality, the preconception has become our reality. I think Iraq today is a country of Shiite, Sunnis, and Kurds. I think the U.S. administration there, I think the exile parties that returned to Iraq after Saddam's fall brought this notion of organizing politics around ethnicities, around sex, and I think that's become the case. And I think that's, to me, that's the danger that we're seeing in Iraq
today.
Much
to the horror, you write, of many Iraqis who did have a sense of pan-sectarian nationalism.
You know, we mentioned Lebanon earlier. One caller mentioned Lebanon. And, you know, you go to Lebanon, it's a country of, I think, 19, 20 different sects of, you know, Greek Orthodox, mm-hmm. Maronite Christians, Sunni, you know, Sunni Muslim, Shiite Muslim, Druze. It's not, you know, people, you know, it's happened to me where I get out of the airport and the first thing the taxi driver asks me is, you know, what my affiliation is. It's not the case in Iraq. Baghdad, if you ask somebody if they're Sunni or Shiite in Baghdad, it's often an offensive question. It's kind of an insult. You just, it's not, it's rude, you know, to ask
them. But people
them
are
that.
Being driven into those camps anyway.
They're being driven into that identification. I think, and I don't want to play down the importance of sect and ethnicity under Saddam. It was extremely important, but it wasn't the sole axis around which politics were organized, and it is becoming that way. And it's becoming, you know, I think maybe 20, 30 years ago, if you asked somebody, well, who are they? They would say Arab, Muslim, Iraqi. Now more and more, I think it is, you know, they're Sunni or they're Shiite. And this is something that is relatively, I think that soul identification is something that's new.
Whether they like it or not. Michael's calling from Northampton, Massachusetts. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
A terrific topic. I wonder whether we've been so hung up on this dream of a united democratic Iraq that we really have made a fundamental mistake and have failed to recognize that it never really was a united Iraq. That it's always been at least three separate regions that were sort of artificially merged, as I understand it, by the British back in the early 20th century. There's this great fear of an inevitable civil war or an existing civil war. Could we correct our mistake and get ahead of this problem by acknowledging that it is three separate areas and allow them to be three separate areas or even countries?
In other words, forget the vision of the United Democratic Iraq. Go with the three. Michael, thanks for your call. Anthony Shadid here. I mean, this is going right in the face of what you were just saying, mm-hmm. that many Iraqis had themselves adopted the one nation view. But we need some resolution has to emerge here.
In a way, I think this is like what the caller was kind of laying out is the logical consequence of that preconception that I talked about that we brought into Iraq in the first place. You know, I think there's a certain inevitability that the Kurds are going to enjoy effective independence or even formal independence in northern Iraq. I think it's already happening. I think the border is being redrawn, often in very thuggish ways. I think the Peshmerga, the Kurdish forces, are abducting hundreds of people there to an attempt to redraw this border. It's not going to be pretty how that border is redrawn. I think it's a different, though, among the Arabs, the Sunni Arabs and Shiite Arabs. I'm always struck by this vein of Iraqi nationalism that I think is still very powerful. And I think if you ask most Sunnis and Shiites, do they want the country divided? Do they want Sunni and Shiite states? I think the answer would be no. And I feel pretty strongly about that. I mean, it's rare in a conversation that I hear outside of formerly exiled politicians or some of these parties that are part of this power game express an idea of partition. It just doesn't seem to be out there. And to be honest, I don't see how you would draw the border. I mean, there's a lot of intermarriage in Baghdad. There's a lot of people who have Sunni and Shiite relatives.
Yeah.
There's some tribes that are both Sunni and Shiite. It's much more complicated. I mean, it would be very difficult to draw a line on the map and say, these are going to be the two states.
And you write, you bring in a wrinkle that doesn't get much attention here. That is, within the Shiite community itself, those who are close to Iran and those who are opposed to Iranian influence, we see almost a new presumption that Iraq may very well emerge as kind of the stepchild of Shia Iran next door. But Muqtada al-Sadr, for one, is very opposed to that. Shiites are not monolithic in supporting this new sway of Iran. Might Shiites themselves go at one another?
Exactly. I think that's such a good point. I mean, that's when I said there's a semblance of civil war underway. I don't think this is a civil war that's pitting Sunnis against Shiites, Shiites against Kurds. I just don't. I mean, there is some of that, obviously, and I think we've seen the killings and the massacres. But when we talk about a semblance of civil war underway, it's the rivalries within the communities. It's, for instance, like you mentioned Sadr, you know, whose militia, I mean, is, you know, chomping at the bit to go after the Supreme Council guys. I mean, there's such deep tension and deep resentment there. A lot of it is over this conception. You know, are we allied with Iran? Are we Arabs? You know, what is our notion of activism? I mean, it's very, you know, very basic questions. How do we see ourselves as a movement? their rivals would see themselves as a clandestine movement. The Sadr guys see themselves as like
right
a
up front militia,
mm-hmm. exactly, and very you know very kind of in your face in a way. You look out in the West among Sunnis, and there is a division between Arab fighters and foreign fighters. There is a division between Iraqi fighters themselves over what the insurgency is about, and there's divisions among the Kurds, no question. So I think you know I think if we're going to watch it, you know, the future of this country, it's going to be less pitting these communities against each other and more what happens in this contest for power within the communities.
Wow, what a fractured picture. Noreen is calling from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Noreen, you're on the air.
Hi. I think that the guest is neglecting the story of the young man who was killed by his father.
The one who was helping out the U.S. and Iraqi forces.
Right, and by the other young men who keep joining the Iraqi government army instead of the insurgency.
Mm-hmm.
I see a young, at least some of them, the new ones, not the old people, but the young ones, seeing a different future for Iraq, one that has hope and democracy, that they will fight those things of chaos.
Let us pick it up, Noreen. Okay. Thank you very much. Anthony, what about it? Is that there? Is that still in play? Is it a possibility that vein wins?
There are examples of that, and I think the caller's right. There are examples of that. There's no question about that. I don't want to say, the last thing I want to do is say that there is one perspective out there, that there's one sentiment. I mean, that's what the book is about in a way, is that it is usually gray, and you do see people disagree with this. I think when we look at Sabah, the guy who was killed by his father, he did it for money. I mean, let's face it, he did it for money, and he was, you know, he'd spent a lot of time in jail. He was a bit of an opportunist. I think when we see, you know, there's entire neighborhoods of Baghdad at this point, entire neighborhoods where everybody from 18 to 30 is trying to join the security forces, and, you know...
Because?
You know, I'll be blunt here. I mean, I think they're doing it because it's the best salary available in the country right now. You know, there's not no one's speaking with a national vision in Iraq right now. No one is speaking about what this country is going to look like and beyond a sectarian or an ethnic lens. And I think that translates all the way down to the security forces, that there are people in the security forces who are fighting for a better country. There's no question about it. They believe in Iraq. They believe in the future. And they want a better future. I don't necessarily think that's the majority. I think if we really have to be honest, we're saying that the majority are there because it is the best paying job and they want to support their families and their families come, you know, first.
Anthony Shadid, you spent a lot of time in Iraq. You're headed back there next week. You paint a picture in grays here without clear blacks and whites. What takes you back? I mean, the risk is greater than ever being a reporter there. The story is, in a way, unending, and yet you're walking back into it. What is it that draws you back?
You know, I asked that question, and I'm not sure I know the answer to it. You know, I still believe that this is, you know, I've spent, you know, much of a decade covering the Arab world, and, you know, I realized that day that I was standing on Saadun Street back on April 9th, and I still realize it today, that this is the story that is going to decide so much about a region that I feel close to, that I'm invested in, that I've lived in for a long time. And, you know, I feel like there's a role for me in trying to chronicle this, like what we call as journalists, you know, chronicle this story. And it's a story that, you know, that's it gives you pause a little bit, and it also makes you wonder that I do think we're in the beginning stages of it. I'm not sure what's next, and I guess that's what keeps you coming back, is to try to find out what is next.
The beginning stages was all we've seen. That's a very sobering thought. It makes it sound as though it could be the story of the rest of your life, the story of Americans' lives and Iraqis for years.
You know, I wonder, you know, you think back to the reporters in Vietnam in the early 60s, you know, when they, you know, I think a lot of them saw this as like, you know, was this story reaching a climax? And, you know, it went on for another 15 years. And I just wonder if we're not the reporters at the beginning of the Iraq war and ready for a long haul ahead.
Anthony Shadid, you take us in close, and we thank you for that. We thank you for being with us. Good luck when you return to Iraq, and we look forward to your reporting.
Thank you.
Anthony Shadid, Pulitzer Prize winning reporter for The Washington Post, author of the new book, Night Draws Near, Iraq's People in the Shadow of America's War. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Matt Lieber, Mary Moore, James Ross, Christina Russo, and Karen Schiffman. With help from Matt Odette and Vince Fairchild, our senior producer is Joe O'Connor. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.